It's great to see all of you, and the weather, I think, is cooperating. It looks like it's the sun's coming back out. So welcome, all of you, to the VPR Listener Picnic. And it is my great pleasure to introduce someone I love to listen to each and every day. Most of you listen to Robin doing her show Here and Now out of Boston, but you may not know her extensive career in journalism, and it goes back quite a few years. This is a woman who has won a Peabody as a documentary filmmaker. She's racked up 5 Emmy Awards in her work for television.
Oh, thank you.
And now graces the public radio airwaves. And I want to go back even further. I thought it was very interesting, one of your first jobs that I read about, maybe launching your career in media, was as an assistant director to help telecast Boston Red Sox games and Boston Bruins games.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea what a puck was. And I was a quota baby in the 70s. Anybody remember what a quota babies were? Quota babies were when the government decided, because of the women's movement in 1970, Congress decided that in order to hold broadcast licenses, television stations had to hire minorities, women, the disabled. And I was the first, no, there were two other women. They were both secretarial. I was the first non-secretarial woman at TV 38 in Boston. And they only hired me because they had to keep their license, and I was immediately assigned directing the Red Sox and the Bruins. And I was like, where the puck is the puck? I had no idea. I had to follow the puck, and I had to watch the game, but it was phenomenal, and it was a great opportunity.
Did that job, is that the job that made you think, yeah, I want to go into media?
Well, it's interesting. I grew up in New York, very familiar with Vermont. Can I just say, I'm so thrilled to be here. I wasn't kidding when I said half my family was here. They are. Come to Vermont for a long time. My cousins are from Middlebury. My cousin married into Lyons General Store. I don't know if any of you remember that in Middlebury. My uncle taught at Middlebury High School and love Vermont and love being up here. But I just didn't know. I didn't know what to do in the 70s. It wouldn't have occurred to me. I thought I was going to. In fact, I was a mother's helper in Colorado when I saw this incredible show, Sesame Street. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to use video and work with children. So I got in my car, and I drove straight from Colorado to Boston because I thought all great things came from New England. I'm a New Yorker. And I arrived, I did, and I arrived at the door of Channel 2, and I presented myself as someone who was there to work with Jim Henson on Sesame Street. And she said, oh, honey, they make that in New York. So I had no money, and I went over to a couple other stations, and that's I've got the first job was directing Bruins and Red Sox, and then I wrote a very impassioned letter to WBZ Radio, which at that time had no women on the air. And I handwrote, in 1973, I handwrote this impassioned letter about, I can't believe we have this women's movement, and you have no women on the air, a 50,000-watt station. And on a Tuesday afternoon, I got a call. A fellow said, hi, this is Dave Graves. I'm the head of production at WBZ. What are you doing Saturday night? And I said, I can't believe it. I was serious. I wrote you a very serious letter, and here you are hitting on me. And he said, no, I'm not. We have an opening Saturday night. What are you doing Saturday night? And that Saturday night, I started doing Midnight to 5 on WBZ. And I have to say, these people were doing it because they had to. This is how they kept their licenses. But they were so generous to me. I mean, I was doing Midnight to 5 radio. I had never been in a radio booth before. And directing Bruins and Red Sox, so there was a nice symbiosis there. They were helping me, I was helping them, and that's it kind of went from there. A program called Evening Magazine was created in Boston. I know we have some Bostonians here, and it went from there, yes. Bostonians.
You know, you talked about liking Sesame Street and wanting to work with video, and you did go on to work in video. Mm-hmm. You worked for a long time in television, CBS, NBC, doing morning shows, filling in as a host, correspondent. Do you miss working now in radio? Do you miss pictures? Do you miss the video?
You know, I don't miss television at all. I'm so sad about television. I can't even. I can't believe what's happened to it. You know, it's just. There's, of course, wonderful pockets of wonderful coverage and wonderful programming, but I don't miss that. And I always was a fan of audio. When something called wireless microphones came, it changed our life. Because we could suddenly stand back from subjects, way back from subjects, and we could take that pressure away, and we could hear these wonderful sounds. I mean, one of the greatest moments ever in, you know, 30, 40 years of working with video wasn't the picture. There was a young man in a documentary I worked on who had AIDS, and we were discussing with the family whether or not to do a documentary, and the father was wearing his radio microphone when the son suddenly took a turn for the worse, and we were just sitting in the living room waiting for him. And so you see in the frame this door to the bedroom, and it's the son struggling to say, "Dad, I can't do it anymore." And then the father saying, "Okay," meaning, "We'll let you die." Well, there's no picture there. So we were always, for Evening Magazine, for the early work on the Today Show, it was always about the intimacy of what people said. Sure, photography is wonderful, and I love photography, but radio for me is sort of the, going back to, because I started at WBZ, but being in public radio, is being able to go back to what I think is the most important part of communication, which is just the breath, you know, just that intimacy between people.
You've been in communications a long time, and I know when I started taking journalism classes, I was learning on a typewriter, so that dates me. And
I was back in the Paleozoic era. I don't think we even had typewriters.
but you know, technology has changed so much from the days, you know, when I would edit audio tape with a razor blade and a wax pencil,
right.
And, you know, digital now, everybody's tweeting. Do you find, as a journalist, now that you're hosting a program, you know, the deadlines are kind of constant? You know, you have to tweet, you have to update Facebook, yeah. You have to have updates on the web. You're probably in the studio long after the show wraps in case there are more updates. Do you like that? Are you a techie, or do you find that burdensome?
I have mixed emotions about it. I use it all the time. First of all, I just tweeted out, oh, he's gone. Oh, my gosh. I just tweeted out, I so have to have Joshua Panda on my program. You know, I so have to have him on. Oh, and I'm so sorry he's gone, because you could buy his underwear. He was selling his underwear over there with his name on it. and I tweeted him, and I tweeted out to his followers. And, you know, during the Arab Spring in Egypt, our program was, it's not about being ahead of anybody. It's about having the content and being right and having the quality. But we were first on the scene, because very early on, we got right into the Twitter feeds from Egypt. And that's why we had Walid Ghanem, who I'm sure I just didn't pronounce that correctly, but he was the Google executive in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, who was leading the uprising. And that's why we had him on the program all the time. In fact, when President Mubarak finally stepped down, we had the very first words from Walid Ghanem in Tahrir Square. And I can't paraphrase it and do it justice, but it was something about, they said it would take 20,000 voices or something. That was on our program, because the minute it happened, we tweeted him and said, call us now at this number. And he got our tweet in Tahrir Square. So there's something very compelling about that. On the other hand, I don't sleep. You know, I don't know sometimes what to trust. The venom that's on social media it can be very upsetting. We felt that a lot around the Boston bombing, and I know you're going to talk about that. But there's also just this scattershot kind of, it's great that everybody has a voice, and then sometimes it's not great that everybody has a voice. And so this idea that there's a constant news flow, this is part of what the change in our program is about, and we'll probably take questions about that. But, you know, NPR was watching us and seeing, wow, we have Walid Ghanem on, and we will drop everything. We don't care. We'll just throw our whole program out and put him on if we get him from Tahrir Square. Or when the Newtown shootings happen, we throw our whole program out. We have a real muscle for that on Here and Now. Just, okay, let's, no matter what we had planned, let's go with what's happening. And I know NPR has been in a lot of discussions about this, because we still want to be the place where it's the best coverage, not the first coverage. It needs to be the best. It needs to be quality. It needs to be accurate. But at a certain point, when everyone is going to their Twitter feed to see what's going on and wondering why you're not telling them about what's happening with the children in Newtown, you have to be there.
And for those of you in the audience, we will open this discussion up and take your questions in a few minutes. I just wanted to chat for a few more minutes with Robin. Take us behind the scenes of the show, and how you weed through all the tweets and what's coming in. We tune you in at 1 o'clock on VPR, and we hear what may or may not be a finished product. Obviously, it's a product in the making because it's live radio. But take us behind the scenes. How early does your day start?
Yeah. Well, I get up at 5, and that's to just get my mind straight. I do my whatever my things I need to do with the cats. And then just really start watching the news, 5:30 on. We watch all the morning programs. We watch the, because our job isn't to do what Morning Edition does. Morning Edition is sort of letting you know from work they've done the night before what the day may bring and what the day is somewhat already bringing. But our job is to be on top of, okay, what is breaking after Morning Edition? So we start getting a sense of that. We already have pre-produced things. It's a pretty standard. You know, we love doing the arts, and things like that are usually produced the day before. Then we are all in by 7, and we start the meeting / World War II wrestling event that passes for our meeting, where we each try to make the case for what we want on the program. And then we start frantically, not frantically, we start calling the people to get them to be involved in the program. So I would say, now we've expanded to 2 hours in some markets. The 2 hours are completely different. So we have a lot to fill. Even when I was doing the 1 hour alone for years, it's a lot to fill. I would say 50% of it maybe on tape on an average day, 50% live. Then, of course, if there's breaking news, we can maybe go 100% live. But that means that if we reach John McCain and we wanted to talk about the consumer board and with Elizabeth Warren, and he can only do it before he goes into Congress, well, then we will have to talk to him at 10. Or it may mean we were going to talk to somebody on tape at 1 o'clock for you, but we get the call from someone else. Well, we'll switch it out and put them on. So the morning is pretty hectic of both trying to reach people, but then also taping the people you might have reached who can only do it then, plus putting the last-minute touches on that jewel that you're going to carry to the show that you've worked on for a day. You know the feeling? It's like we work so hard on the arts pieces or the some of the intimate conversations. You're still editing those. Editing is all done in your computer. I edit at home. I usually edit about 2 hours every night on my computer. It's just a cut-and-paste system, so sometimes when I have long conversations, or if I've come up to a place like this and I'm going to be taping here, I'll cut that myself at home. And then in the morning, we're just trying to gather it all. It's kind of complicated because I now will have to kill all of you because now you'll know what we do. But we have our show at 12 and 1. You carry the 1 o'clock. But then we also are there for the West Coast stations at 2 and 3. So our first week that we went with a co-host and expanded is when all hell broke loose in Egypt. So we were on the air from 12 to 4 in the afternoon, but you heard 1 hour. So in your hour, we might have been hearing Morsi's going to make a speech, but at 2 o'clock he's made the speech, so we have to dump everything out and do that
at 2 o'clock. Constantly updating.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the other shows that, or topics, obviously, that happened right in your backyard was the Boston Marathon bombing, yeah. Which, you know, you were covering it extensively. And I don't know if some of the folks in this audience realize you had a very unusual or, you know, surprising connection to the 19-year-old bombing suspect. This is a young man who'd been in your home. He was a friend of your nephew. They were high school classmates, good friends. He'd been at a prom party. Talk about once you realized who that connection, what were the talks in the editor's office about how do we get that across?
This was pretty shattering. First and foremost, I mean, I just both preface, but first and foremost, the most shattering thing, and we're still, this was horrible. We all knew somebody who lost a limb. I mean, just about everybody in Boston knows somebody who's an amputee. The two of the teachers at the school where my nephew went, Cambridge Ringe and Latin, their child and their son and his wife, newlyweds, both lost their legs. And then we find out, and this is how we found out. So that's first and foremost our main concern. And I say that, and you'll see why I made such an effort to say that. So Thursday night, I had actually had a speaking engagement Thursday night. We were coming back from Concord, the Walden forums, and we saw all of this police activity. We knew something was wrong. Well, that turned out to be the car chase. The MIT officer had just been killed, and this huge car chase was now making its way over to Watertown, which is right next to Cambridge where I live. And we all said, this is more than just a fire. Something's going on. Some of us started tweeting, picking up on Twitter again that somebody had been killed at MIT, that this was the chase of the suspects. So we all came in. So we were all in 2, 3, 4 in the morning that morning. Jonathan Peck, who some VPR people know, who's our marketing guy, lived on the street where the the shootout occurred between the chasing FBI and the two suspects, and they threw the last pressure cooker that they had in and exploded right in front of his house. So Jonathan Peck is on the phone with us on WBUR on the radio telling us there's something, you know, there's a military skirmish going on outside my house. He was in lockdown for most of the day, as was all of Boston. And those of us who came in the morning got in, but then the lockdown came, so we had a very bare-bones staff. You couldn't go anywhere because of the lockdown. So at about 6 o'clock in the morning, the night before, Thursday night, they had released the pictures. I remember looking at the pictures and thinking, that young one looks like Sean Penn. No connection. Thursday night, they kill the cop. They have the chase, and Friday morning, because of the pictures, people who knew Jahar better and knew his brother were all calling saying it's the Tsarnaev brothers. So they released the name at about, I think, 6:30, 7 o'clock. Friday morning, they released the name and Cambridge Rindgen Latin and 19. Well, my nephew went to Cambridge Rindgen Latin. He's 19. I didn't recognize the name even because it was spelled D-J-O-H-K, something, and I knew him as J-A-H-A-R, Jahar. So I called my nephew, and it was gut-wrenching because the whole time was gut-wrenching. I can't explain it. You had the floods here. You know what it's like to have that, you know, your blood turns cold when you're realizing, you know, houses are going into creeks and things. It's that, you're having that feeling the whole time, stomach turning. Well, I finally get my nephew, and I said, wake up, because of course he's 19. He hadn't looked at the TV, and he goes, oh, my God, it's Jahar. It's Jahar. Jahar Tsarnaev was one of the most popular kids in this class. The morning of that event, they came out and said, the two suspects were disenfranchised immigrants who weren't accepted at their elite Cambridge Academy. Well, I don't know what my nephew was more insulted by. He lives in public housing, he wouldn't mind me saying. This Cambridge Rindgen Latin has mostly kids in public housing. People from Harvard send their children to private schools. These are kids so fiercely proud of their school and their diversity and their ability to get along. My nephew's class had 45 languages in it. He said, Aunt Robin, he was the most popular kid. I said, I know. He wasn't disenfranchised. We accepted him, and we're no elite academy. Like that was some big insult. He said, I have to talk about this. And, you know, my news director was there. Everything was running around trying to figure out what's going on. Everybody was in. Our general manager, who's a great newsman, was there. And I said, look, I have my nephew. He knows him. And they were like, we almost have a responsibility at this point. So I said to my nephew, and I knew Jahar. We had the prom party in my backyard. Every single picture that I have of these 100 kids came. They pitched in and bought a trolley. You know, so nobody drove and had their pictures taken in the backyard. Every single picture that every single parent has, and by the way, you haven't seen them because everybody's been very private about them, Jahar is in the center of every scrum of kids. He was just a delightful, lovely, he was Muslim, so if once or twice when kids got in trouble drinking, Jahar was the one that drove them home because he never drank. I mean, to say we were shocked was an understatement, but the decision to put him on, I said, Zolan, your life is about to change because you're going to be the first person in the world to talk about him. He said,
this is your nephew.
I'm sorry, my nephew Zolan. And so we went on our morning edition immediately, and he said that. He described who he was. My nephew is studying journalism at Northeastern. He works for the Boston Globe as a paid intern. He knows what he's doing. And he just said, here's the one I knew. Here's what he did. He was on the wrestling team. He was a mentor. He won a scholarship. We never could have seen this coming. You have to know this was not the disenfranchised kid. Immediately, within an hour, we had 900 media requests. He did a couple more interviews. I did too. The hate that came was unbelievable. We were picked up by a lot of conservative bloggers. Nobody wanted to hear that somebody who could be a monster could ever have been some but one of us. No one wanted to hear that. And so that was the next wave of just these kids at Cambridge Rindgen Latin, this is the Twitter sphere, how attacked they were, but they stood by it. And the narrative never changed. This terrible Rolling Stone cover story that we're living through right now, don't think they should have put that picture on the cover, but what they're trying to say is the same thing. This is a new narrative. it makes it easier if we think it's a disenfranchised kid who nobody accepted, who maybe had a grudge or had a family that we could see. Nobody saw this, and that's, to me, what makes this so much scarier.
In the few minutes left, I wanted to make sure all of you, if you had follow-up questions, it's pretty riveting. I mean,
I'm sorry to take so much time.
No, I think we're all kind of hanging because it is really kind of a surprise. It is easier to
and
think
by the way,
of
that
as some...
I just want to say one brief thing, and that when he appeared in... all of us are trying to figure out how did this happen, and is there something I could have seen done to help this kid? I'm convinced that there wasn't. His wrestling coach went to the hearing with all the wrestling team members to say, Jahar, please, can we see? Is there something? He spoke with a Russian accent. Nobody in the national press picked this up. Speaking in a Russian accent, they said, this young man does not have a Russian accent. Never had a Russian accent. I'm convinced he's had a psychotic break. The person that was in that hearing with a Russian accent was unrecognizable to us.